I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Law enforcement officials are warning that terrorists deployed inside the United States are planning a major attack this summer. The Associated Press cites an unnamed senior counterterrorism official as saying the reports are extremely credible, but they contain no information about the time, place, or method of attack. Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge seemed to downplay the threat this morning on NBC's Today Show.
I can confirm that we have seen over the past several weeks a continuous stream of reporting that talks about the possibility of attacks in the United States, not unlike what we've seen for the past several years.
Ridge said there is no plan to raise the threat level from its current mid-level, Code Yellow. FBI Director Robert Mueller and Attorney General John Ashcroft are expected to hold a joint press conference about the threat this afternoon in Washington. We're joined by Josh Meyer, who covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Gil.
Is this any different from all the other times that federal officials have warned of increased chatter, no specific information, but signals that something might be about to happen?
It actually might be different in the sense that, in this case, they're offering us even less than they have at some times in the past. I mean, if you listen to what Ridge said this morning, if you really parse it, he said the chatter, as they call it, is not unlike what we've seen in the past several years. And that really gives you an indication of how vague it is. Certainly they're concerned that the two conventions are going to be of interest to terrorists, but I don't think that they're giving out anything very specific right now in terms of intelligence that they've received.
Overall, then, with such nebulous information, how seriously should we take this? I mean, what does this mean in terms of additional precautions?
It's always been hard to quantify what they're saying and what people can do about it. I mean, I can't help but go back to a Saturday Night Live skit, which spoofed the whole thing, where John Ashcroft was saying, basically, we're about to get attacked, but go about your lives and pretend I didn't even tell you that. You know, it's hard to really tell people exactly what to do with that information. I think they're asking people to be vigilant. I think they're probably going to issue a list of some names, perhaps even photos of people that they would like to question. But I think that they're hoping that the public cooperates with them and looks for anything suspicious and reports it to the authorities.
Well, and as you know, there was an FBI bulletin last week that asked people to be on the lookout for people wearing bulky jackets in the summertime or going around in clothing that smells of chemicals or trailing wires. Did they say what we're supposed to do if we see somebody like that?
Well, I think that they always say, don't do anything yourself, contact the appropriate authorities. But, it's just very confusing. I mean, I think it was about a year and a half ago they issued a similar bulletin saying, watch out for homeless people and street sweepers and even vendors who might be terrorists looking to case important federal buildings or other sites. And I can tell you that they are very concerned about the two conventions. They're also concerned about the G8 summit on Sea Isle, Georgia, in early June. But there's some people that are concerned that they're going to try to hit soft targets like subways, even malls or bars to cause havoc in that sort of way.
One piece of the puzzle is whether an attack might be aimed at the November election, especially given the change in Spain's government after the Madrid bombing. So
right.
Does that give officials any clues in terms of where or when a terror attack might happen?
Not at all. I mean, actually, the Madrid bombings are a perfect case study of that. I mean, some of the more cynical people might say that this is an effort by the government to sort of cover themselves in case anything does happen. I'm not sure if I agree with that. I think that they're trying to get as much information out there as they can.
But in terms of the official level of concern, I mean, you're someone who covers terrorism. Is this higher than you have seen it before?
No. I mean, actually, in around Christmas time in December, I can say that they were much more alarmed then than they are now.
Josh, thank you.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke to us from Washington.
Well, a British think tank estimates that the Al-Qaeda network has at least 18,000 potential terrorist members around the world, and that the war in Iraq is helping, not hurting, their recruitment efforts. The International Institute for Strategic Studies today released its annual review of global security. One of its most chilling phrases, an Al-Qaeda leader is quoted as saying 4 million Americans will have to be killed as a prerequisite to any Islamic victory. Terry Taylor is president of the Institute's U.S. offices. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. And Terry, first of all, tell us, how did you arrive at the number of 18,000?
Well, first of all, the 18,000 are not all active terrorists. I think what we're pointing out is there are up to 18,000 people who've been through the Al-Qaeda training camps between 1996 and around 2000. Not all of them will have turned into active terrorists. So it would be a small proportion of those who would be active. But that's a kind of reservoir which al-Qaeda and its supporting groups could draw upon.
Right. You write that 20,000 actually went through the camps. 2,000 are estimated to have been killed, so that leaves 18,000. Yeah. But conversely, couldn't there be thousands more who never went through the camps who have since been provoked to join?
I mean, I think we're not just doing simple arithmetic by deducting 2,000 and saying 18,000 left. What we're saying, probably less than 18,000 would be likely to join the al-Qaeda cause. Yeah. But the ranks would have been swelled by people like the group from based in Morocco who carried out the Madrid bombings.
Right. So it's a conservative estimate?
Well, we think it is. And I stress again, we're not saying all of those are active terrorists.
Yeah. Compare al-Qaeda to other organizations we're familiar with. I'm thinking of the IRA, for instance. What can we learn from that comparison? Or is al-Qaeda uniquely different from other nationalist movements?
It's completely different from nationalist movements because the IRA you could negotiate with. So these groups have a territorial kind of ambitions in relation to autonomy over their own place in their own particular countries are very different. With al-Qaeda, it's a non-negotiable position.
Right. But you also write that there are things we can learn from, for instance, watching the IRA in its latter days.
Yes, I think that's where the group became marginalized, at least the military action part of it became marginalized. And in that instance, the military attacks, I hesitate to use the word military, the terrorist attacks became more extreme. And in fact, they became self-defeating. The dreadful bombing in Omar was a watershed.
This is when so many school children were killed.
Yeah, that's right. And so it just alienated any public support, although many in the Catholic community in Northern Ireland, perhaps some in Southern Ireland, had sympathy with the objectives, but they just were disgusted by the methods.
Can you briefly tell us, of the 18,000 possible terrorist members of al-Qaeda that you feel exist, how many of them are at the core?
Well, I think that's so hard to estimate, but it would be a minority. It would only take, and this is just my Terry Taylor's personal estimate, if you had 2,000 of them who are absolutely determined and wanted to carry out very serious attacks against the United States, UK, and other countries, and moderate Islamic countries too, that would be a really difficult international challenge of itself.
And how is their money doing?
Well, there's been a change in the metamorphosis from the hierarchical structure when Osama bin Laden was in Afghanistan, when he was the sort of central point of financial distribution. Now it's now the local groups, like the group from Morocco who carried out the bombings in Spain, they raise their own money. And you have to remember, these attacks do not cost a lot of money to mount.
And to fight terror costs billions.
To fight terror costs billions, I'm afraid, in order, if you still want to have, which of course we will, have open societies and so on, it costs a lot of money.
Terrence Taylor, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Terry Taylor, President and Executive Director for the U.S. of the International Institute for Strategic and International Studies.
A key aide to rebel Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has been captured in a raid in Najaf today and will be handed over to Iraqi authorities. His arrest comes as coalition forces are negotiating with the cleric's Mahdi army in an attempt to turn the militia into a political organization. Sadr's followers have been growing in strength and number since early April, and there's been intense fighting between the militia and coalition forces around the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala. Officials have previously said that Sadr himself should either be captured or killed. Orly Halpern is covering that story for the Christian Science Monitor. She joins us on the line from Baghdad. And Orly, the coalition has said repeatedly that it would not negotiate with militias and criminals. Sadr would seem to qualify on both counts, so why the change?
Negotiations are taking place because there is basically no time left. We're just a few weeks before the handover, and basically the coalition has to give security power as much as possible to the Iraqis. They don't want to be seen as still doing the job themselves. So for that to happen, this conflict has to end. There were two conflicts, as you probably remember. There was Fallujah and simultaneously the breakout of the Shiite rebellion in the south of the country. So they already solved this problem in a similar way in Fallujah. They basically hired the people that were fighting them. they realized that that was going to be the way to quiet the situation. And it appears this is what's, from my sources, this is what's going to happen now. They're not going to be hiring them. They'll probably be integrating them into a ICDC, which is a Civil Defense Corps. Basically, Sutter wanted from the beginning, Sutter wanted to be part of the original governing council, and he wasn't invited, and that really made him unhappy. And he's been fighting the coalition since then. And basically now, by engaging them, they'll be neutralizing them.
As you say, Sutter, this is something that he's been wanting all along. What does the coalition get out of it?
The coalition gets quiet, which is what it needs at this point at any cost. They can't properly do the handover as long as fighting is going on.
What are the terms of this agreement?
Well, from what I understand, it's a four-point agreement. Basically, coalition forces will be leaving the holy cities, the city of Karbala, Najaf. They've already left Karbala. And they will not be arresting militia. The militia will just leave. They will not be going around the cities armed. The third point is that the militia will give back anything it's taken, whether it be police cars or guns. And the fourth point is that it will be integrated into the whole militia, the whole Sutter movement will be become a political entity.
Well, now, does Sutter appear to still be in control of his militia? If he tells them to stand down, will they? And do they appear to want to become a political entity?
That's an excellent question. The problem, I think, that both Sutter and Bremer and coalition will face is if Sutter can actually tell his people, you know, put down your arms. But when you have, for instance, like Sutter City in Baghdad, this sprawling slum where many of the Mahdi army leaders have been arrested by coalition forces, it's basically going to be up to very young guys to decide whether they're going to put down their arms, because there's not many leaders around to tell them. And on the ground, as one Mahdi army leader told me, you know, when it comes to self-defense, we decide for ourselves. We don't take orders from anyone.
And does it make a real difference as to whether they're operating as a militia or as a political organization, or is it a change in name only?
I think it does make a difference. I think that if you do have people engaged in the political process, they're, first of all, less likely to be violent. They're going to be part of the system. Another problem would be is that by basically having them incorporated into official security forces, you have to really make sure that they're trained properly and they don't have the kind of lawlessness attitude that they have now, that they can do whatever they want.
Orly, thank you.
You're welcome.
Orly Halpern writes for the Christian Science Monitor. She joined us from Baghdad.
Just ahead, Richard Nixon wasn't the only one with secret tapes. Today, the bulk of Henry Kissinger's transcripts are made public.
And later, the Boston Archdiocese says it will close 65 churches.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
We're learning a lot more about another White House in wartime. Today, the federal government released 33,000 additional pages of transcripts of high-level telephone conversations secretly recorded by Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon's security advisor and secretary of state. The release of information from Kissinger's so-called telcons, telephone communications, is the culmination of a nearly 30-year legal battle to bring them out in the open. Joining us on the line is Tom Blanton. He's director of the National Security Archive, which was instrumental in getting the transcripts released. And Tom, tell me, first of all, where are you now?
I'm standing in the sunlit lobby of the main National Archives building out here in College Park, Maryland. Right downstairs from me, actually practically right under my feet, is a little gray bunker room called Lecture Hall A. It's full of folding tables and gray acid-free cardboard boxes lining one wall that are full of these thousands of pages of the Kissinger telcons. About 30 people are down there right now, about six scanners hooked up to laptops. Everybody's just pouring through them looking for these gems and nuggets from these phone calls. It's like being a fly on the wall in Kissinger's office, you know, or his home, actually, because even transcribed and taped the calls from his home.
Well, how did you and your agency obtain these papers? And remind us, there, you know, there had been some other communications between Kissinger and Nixon and others released earlier. So just tell us a little
That's
bit about
right.
the battle to get these out.
Well, if you remember Watergate, the Nixon tapes became the center of the entire Watergate scandal. And when Kissinger was leaving office in 1976, people were asking, where are your records? Where are your documents? He had hauled them off to the Rockefeller estate in Pocantico Hills, New York. And then I think his lawyers probably told him, hold on there, Henry, you might get caught for theft of government property. So he cut a deal with the Library of Congress, put him under lock and key.
And by the way, we should remind our listeners, the Library of Congress is not under the same Freedom of Information Act as other places where papers are stored.
Exactly. Congress exempted itself from the Freedom of Information Act. So finally, you know, after a whole series of different legal cases that lost because the Freedom of Information Act didn't apply to Congress, we had the bright idea of going after the State Department for abdicating its duty under the records laws to keep its records. So they wrote Kissinger a letter saying, we think, as a matter of law, you should turn these back in. And to his credit, at 30 years late, he did the right thing.
Well, Tom,
and it's taken him 2.5 years to declassify them.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you sound practically giddy. Why? What's so important
well,
to you and others?
Let me just read you a little conversation. This is Henry Kissinger receiving a phone call at home at about 8 o'clock at night in October 73 from one of his top aides at the National Security Council, a guy named Brent Scowcroft, went on to be National Security Advisor to President Bush. Scowcroft says, Henry, the switchboard just got a call from 10 Downing Street in London. Ask whether the president, this is President Nixon, would be available for a call about half an hour from now from the prime minister about the Middle East. And Kissinger says, can we tell him no? When I talked to the president just now, he was drunk.
Oh, dear. Well, that's probably unsettling for people to hear. But, I imagine that there are more serious – I mean, that's a very serious conversation. But I imagine there are more sober conversations. What else are you seeing?
There's a couple of the back and forth that actually support some Kissinger's descriptions of how he always had to calm Nixon down. There's a back and forth in December of 1970 where Kissinger calls up and says, we got to, you know, bomb Cambodia. Every plane we've got, let's bomb them. Let's move everything over. And this is at night. This is a phone call again to Kissinger at home from President Nixon. And about 5 minutes after he gets off the phone with President Nixon, he calls his own top aide, Al Haig, and says, just got a call from our friend. He wants total bombing. And the next line is in parentheses. You can see the secretaries just wrote it in. Can't hear what Haig was saying over the sound of laughter. Parentheses. And then they decide at the end, oh, we'll send a few B-52s, and that'll calm Nixon down, blow up some of the jungle. We can tell him we did a strike, but that's it. And you get this bizarre sense of the dysfunctional White House, where part of the job of the aides was to deal with these some of the crazy ideas, some of the mad bomber ideas that Nixon did have.
It's shocking. It might be entertaining for some. But is it significantly different from other things that we've known in the past? I mean, as we know, other transcripts have been released.
Right, but we do have a couple of great examples where Nixon calls Kissinger, for example, to talk about who they're going to send to China to arrange that secret trip to China or the ultimate trip that Nixon took. And Kissinger doesn't know, but Nixon's tape machine is running, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kissinger didn't know about the tapes. But Nixon didn't know that Kissinger's secretaries are listening in, making these transcripts. It's like the ultimate metaphor of the mutual wiretap society. They're bugging each other.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have these transcripts of the phone calls. And next to the Nixon tapes, they put you in the seat of power. And I think the exposure to these things not only is going to change the way a lot of the history of those years has been written, but maybe it will also serve a kind of deterrent effect for current policy holders.
Tom, I've got two quick questions for you before you go. First of all, we know that there's been talk for a long time of charging Henry Kissinger with war crimes in Chile, Cambodia, maybe Argentina. He has never been charged. Do you think these transcripts, I know you've only had a peek at them, but
right.
Will that change that?
We've looked at some key dates, and I don't know that they're going to go right to the war crimes arguments, but they certainly would make him a material witness. to all the investigations currently going on. I know the last time Mr. Kissinger was in Paris, he got served with a subpoena to show up in court.
Right.
A judge there is pursuing what happened to some French citizens who got killed in Chile under Pinochet.
Yeah. And another quick question. Apparently there's a small amount of material in these transcripts released today that relates to John Kerry. Have you seen anything yet?
We haven't seen that yet. There are three reporters down there who are hogging those three boxes, and so I haven't got a chance to look at it. I'm focusing on the Kissinger material, and we're going to post in about an hour, we'll post a dozen or so of the most fun documents, and then later on today we'll post some more at our website, nsarchive.org, so your listeners can see it for themselves.
Tom Blanton, thank you.
Real pleasure, Robin.
Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive, a foreign policy documentation center based at George Washington University.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the New York Times admits error in its coverage of weapons of mass destruction. We'll talk to one of the paper's main critics.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The troubled Archdiocese of Boston delivered the news via Federal Express yesterday, notifying 65 Roman Catholic churches that they will be closed. The closures come as the Archdiocese reorganizes. It recently announced that it would sell its headquarters in order to raise money to pay the victims of clergy sex abuse. All 357 parishes got a letter yesterday. Churches that got the news that they will be kept open chimed their bells in celebration. But for the dozens that will close, it was a day for anger as well as reflection. WBUR's Audie Cornish was at one parish in Dedham, Massachusetts, when the letter arrived.
As parishioners at St. Susanna's in Dedham took communion at the altar where they have broken bread since 1961, a FedEx truck pulled into church grounds with a delivery from the Boston Archdiocese. That package awaited them in the church hall downstairs, where their pastor, Father Steve Gisoma, gathered them together to open a letter from Archbishop Sean O'Malley. A letter that began, Dear Father Gisoma.
After careful consideration and an extensive process of review, I am writing to inform you that I have decided that St. Susanna Parish must close. Not to serve the needs of the people of the Archdiocese.
One by one, parishioners such as Robert Frasca stood up in anger and disappointment.
I, as one who's been here since this church started, I feel like we bought and paid for this church all through these years. If this man come along and take our parish away from us, I can't see that. I will not give one dime anymore to the Archdiocese.
Joseph Griffin also railed against the Archdiocese.
If we allow this, we deserve it. We don't need the Archdiocese of Boston. They need us.
Others raised questions about whether Father Gisoma was being targeted for his efforts to remove Cardinal Bernard Law. Gisoma was one of 58 priests to sign a letter urging the cardinal to resign in 2002. He and other members of the church have also been friendly with the Catholic lay reform group Voice of the Faithful, who later in the day staged a press conference from St. Susanna's front steps.
The Archdiocese offering support and resources to work directly for the pastors of both suppressed and ongoing parishes.
Gisoma says he doesn't know if the parish closure is punitive. He says he does know that when he first came to the church years ago, Cardinal Law promised him it was in good shape and wouldn't be closing anytime soon. Gisoma says he can't understand now why St. Susanna's, debt-free and enjoying increases in collections and mass attendance, would be on the list.
A lot of people didn't lose their faith, but they lost their faith in the institution, but their focus became their parish. And now I think for the diocese at this point to say, we don't need your $10 a week, we'll close your parish and keep your money, and you can go someplace else, is anathema to people here, to think that we're just going to go to the next place.
Parishioner Kathleen Shaheen says she's unclear on what to do next. Her family has worshipped in the church since it opened. To Shaheen, nearby parishes are not in nearly as good physical or financial shape as St. Susanna's.
And, you know, you get laughed at with all the tragedy that's going on and the abuse. Everybody putting down the Catholic Church, and when you stand up for it, and you just feel like they're closing the doors on you.
Longtime parishioner and chair of Dedham's Board of Selectmen, Jim McDonald, says the town may consider zoning measures to severely limit the value and use of the 300-acre lot. He says O'Malley needs to visit St. Susanna's and every other church due to be closed and explain the decisions to parishioners firsthand.
For a church that was trying to bring people back together after the scandal, to try to take the parish, to take the people and say, you know, come to the church, you know, trust in us again, believe in us again. Now there are 60 communities that are saying, you sucked us in, and now you just blew us out again. What are we supposed to do?
Father Gisoma says he's already crafting an appeal. He's meeting with his own parish council in the next few days to discuss what, if anything, can be done. Meanwhile, he and the other parish leaders and closing churches are meeting with leaders from the Archdiocese tomorrow to discuss their future in the church.
WBUR's Audie Cornish at St. Susanna's Parish in Dedham, Massachusetts.
Organizers of the gay and lesbian Catholic group, the Rainbow Sash Movement, are urging members to wear rainbow sashes throughout Pentecost services this Sunday as a symbol of protest against the church's position on homosexuality. The Archdiocese of Chicago has been told to deny communion to anyone wearing the sash, saying a political statement doesn't belong in a sacred moment. Well, joining us on the line from Chicago is Joe Murray, spokesperson for the Rainbow Sash Movement. And Joe, some of your critics say the Chicago Archdiocese is gay-friendly. Why bring a protest inside the church?
We bring it inside because we're Catholics, and that's where we're... Every other group in the church is welcomed into the church. Do we hear issues raised when the Girl Scouts come in, for instance?
Well, the Girl Scouts don't stage protests.
But this isn't a protest. You're seeing it as a protest. We don't buy into the shame factor.
I see what you're saying. You're saying that the members of your organization are just going to wear their sash in the way that a Girl Scout might wear her badge sash?
Right, right. Or the Knights of Columbus, their group, or any ethnic group might wear their outfits. That's not considered a protest. Why is it considered a protest for us to wear rainbow sashes?
Well, is it possibly that part of the church policy might be don't ask, don't tell? In other words, don't draw attention to it. And is that what you're questioning?
What we're questioning is the fact that Cardinal George is very cagey about the use of language. He always talks about us as homosexuals. He never talks about us as gay and lesbian people. And it's easy to use that term homosexual because it's clinical. It has a lot of negative baggage with it. So if you say something public that's positive about gay and lesbian people in the church, you're causing problems. You're opposing the church's teaching. Now, what I personally think about the church's teaching is one thing. But if the cardinal says he welcomes gay and lesbian people, why does he have a problem when they're identified as gay and lesbian people?
Well, what do you say to former members of your group or critics of what you might be doing who are gay and lesbian and Catholic and saying, why rock the boat? Why draw attention? Why start a fight when there really isn't one, that this particular archdiocese has, as I said, been friendly?
This archdiocese has not been friendly. This archdiocese gave us communion once. Cardinal George has refused us communion in the past. If calling for dialogue is rocking the boat, then I guess we're rocking the boat.
What's been the reaction from other archdioceses?
The Archdiocese of Los Angeles will welcome our members into his cathedral, and if they present themselves for communion, they will be given communion. They are part of the Catholic family. It's a public welcome. Hmm. You know, it's not something they're there, but we're not going to talk about them.
And how does that make you feel, that you know that your priest knows that you are gay? Are you trying to force your priest to acknowledge you?
No. I think most priests will pastorally tell me or any other gay Catholic, I support you, and if you're in a committed relationship, I support that. I can do that privately, but I can't do that publicly.
And that's what bothers you?
That's what bothers me. This issue of saying on a pastoral level and not being able to say it in a public level, it smacks of hypocrisy.
Well, Joe, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Joe Murray, spokesperson for the gay and lesbian Catholic group, the Rainbow Sash Movement.
Still to come, the ultimate restaurant reviewer, Mimi Sheridan, reflects on a life of eating out and not being recognized.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Stunt doubles, the people who crash through walls and jump out of cars and windows so movie stars don't have to, are some of the hardest working, unsung heroes of the entertainment industry. Not too long ago, most stunt doubles in Hollywood were men, but women are catching up now thanks to films like Charlie's Angels, The Matrix, and Kill Bill. In Quentin Tarantino's violent film, the stunt double who made Uma Thurman seem invincible was a young New Zealander, Zoe Bell. She's also been in Xena, Warrior Princess, and the upcoming Catwoman. In tonight's televised World Stunt Awards, Zoe's been nominated in two categories, Best Fight and Best Overall Stunt by a Woman, for her work in Kill Bill's opening scene. Here and Now's Andrea Shea recently spoke with stunt double Zoe Bell about what it's like taking the hit for Uma.
Anything that's kind of requires pain, danger, or skill that they can't expect Uma to do definitely falls on me, and a lot of stuff in between, you know. You know, they'd get Uma to do the fight stuff that she could do and wanted to do and they could get her to do, and then they'd swap me out and I'd do the same stuff so that they've got something to cut between. A lot of the wire stuff, you know, like harness flips and all that kind of stuff. Anything where there's a lot of impact to the body or into a wall or whatever, that would be me.
And what was your first job?
My first job was actually being kind of like a stunt extra on a pilot called Amazon High, which was basically a cheerleader going back in time. I wasn't even involved in it, seriously, but it's kind of embarrassing. And cheerleader going back in time. And eventually she meets the bad guy and she cheerleaders him to death. You know, give us an A, crack. Give us a B, crack. It was bad.
How did your family react when you told them you wanted to be a stunt double?
Actually, to be honest, they were stoked. My dad's probably one of the biggest enthusiasts for me doing what it is that I do, based purely on the fact that he knows it's a passion for me. My mum, for the same reasons, loved it, but her kind of catchphrase is, I like hearing the cool bits, don't tell me the scary, dangerous bits. I mean, she knows, but it's just easier for her to not hear about it sometimes, you know?
So what was one of the most dangerous or scariest bits you've ever done?
Well, that was always a hard question for me, but having been on Catwoman, I did a massive descender rig, which is like you're in a harness and wires. It's basically to mimic freefall. And I fell 200 and something stories.
Have you ever been injured?
Yeah. Towards the end of shooting on Kill Bill, I really badly damaged my left wrist. And it's been a year and a half, and I'm walking on my hands again for the first time.
Do you ever encounter any sort of bias against you as a female stunt double? Is it kind of a man's world?
I mean, at risk of sounding kind of like, you know, poor us, we're females, it definitely is that way, but if it was that much of a problem for me, I wouldn't be here doing it. You know what I mean?
Stunt double, Zoe Bell. The World Stunt Awards will be broadcast tonight on Spike TV. Zoe's also the subject of the new documentary, Double Dare. To find out more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Ooh, ow. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The journal Nature Medicine has released a study conducted at three French research institutes showing the presence of prions in sheep leg muscles. Prions, you may remember, are the proteins that are believed to be the cause of brain-wasting diseases, including mad cow. Well, scientists say the amounts are very small and don't seem to pose a significant threat to people who eat mutton or lamb. But one prion expert describes the discovery as a warning. Well, for more on those findings, we turn to Will Houston, professor of epidemiology at the University of Minnesota. Will, welcome.
Glad to join you.
Can you explain for us exactly what prions are and how they're connected to these diseases?
Well, prions is a term that was coined to describe an abnormal protein that is found with all of these brain wasting diseases, these spongy brain diseases that can be transmitted from animal to animal.
And why is this discovery of prions in sheep muscle significant?
Well, heretofore, we have found that these abnormal proteins accumulate in very few tissues, primarily in the brain. And so this is the first discovery or identification of the prion agent in a muscle tissue of a food animal.
People are unlikely to be eating sheep brains, but they might well be eating mutton or lamb. Does this mean that people should stop eating lamb if they want to be on the safe side, or can they safely continue?
Good news there is that people have been eating mutton and lamb and, in fact, have been eating sheep brains. And the work that we've done to date at looking at patterns of disease have not shown any connection between sheep disease and human disease. The agent, this abnormal protein, accumulates at very, very low levels in the muscle tissues of affected sheep. So that's a piece of information to take into consideration.
In February, you may recall, the FDA held an advisory hearing into a wide range of these diseases, including mad cow. Can you bring us up to date in terms of where we are with research, with screening of livestock? Are we doing enough quickly enough?
I suppose you might say that there's a small army of researchers around the world that are investigating these diseases. So what FDA is trying to do is keep apprised of the newest information so that they can keep their regulations and their safeguards up to date with the new science.
Will, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Will Houston is professor of epidemiology at the University of Minnesota.
Mimi Sheridan, longtime food writer for The New York Times, as well as Condé Nast and Time magazine, has had to wear a number of hats and wigs and specially tinted glasses to preserve her anonymity. But now she's coming into the spotlight as herself in a new memoir, Eating My Words, An Appetite for Life. We spoke with Mimi Sheridan recently and found out that being critical of food is in her genes.
Well, my mother was not only a very ambitious and gifted cook, but she liked very much to be praised and to have her cooking assessed, so she would always critique it or ask us to. And she tended to evaluate people by their ability to cook, especially the ability to make good chicken soup. If she said a woman could not make a decent plate of chicken soup, that was the absolute condemnation, meaning the woman was no good in any way and certainly not fit to marry one of my uncles or cousins, which is usually what it was about.
Okay, well, armed with your mother's thoughts about chicken soup, you headed into the restaurants of New York. To their great dismay, often, we said how you wore disguises, but after a while, I mean, did people know it was you?
Well, I would say after several years in the places that are most carefully tuned in, which is to say all the fashionable, trendy places, they certainly were able to get it after a while. But considering how many restaurants there are in New York and how rarely I had to repeat, I had a pretty good long run being anonymous. I had three wigs. I had about six pairs of glasses. And, of course, never made a reservation in my name nor in my husband's, and sometimes made up name, and when I got to the restaurant, forgot which name we had made up. and I would have to apologize and ask to see the reservation book saying I couldn't remember which friends we were dining with.
And I prefer to wear my sunglasses indoors. Well, you tasted over 100 pastrami sandwiches for a piece on a deli. You worked your way through the entire stock of the Bloomingdale's food department, over 1,000 items.
Yes.
And as you've said, some said that was too clinical approach to food. It didn't have the romance. What would you say about your method?
Well, I very much appreciate the romance of food, and I write about it quite a bit, but in other ways. That is not to me what a critique is about. My view, and others may differ, is that the review, as with theater or film or books, tells the reader whether to go to the restaurant or buy the book or see the play, et cetera. It's to help make a choice. And therefore, though you don't want it to be so cold that the reader has no idea of the decor or the tone of the place, so he or she would know what to wear or what mood it might fit, I don't believe in making that the largest part of the review. To me, it's about the food.
As you traveled and ate in so many restaurants, did the New York Times pay for all of this, or were there any junkets? And then further, you know, that happens more and more nowadays. Companies and restaurants will sponsor junkets to taste products of a particular region, for instance. Do journalists have a hard time drawing the line between being the journalist and being...
No, they don't have a hard time. They just can't go on junkets. The rule at the New York Times and later at the Condé Nast Traveler, where I worked, and Time Magazine, the rule was strictly no junkets, no free meals, no free anything. And freelancers have to sign a contract saying that they have not taken anything free or been on junkets. So let's hope that that all works and that nobody does.
In your time, you've seen the restaurant world just explode into a world of celebrity. What do you think of it now? Is it too driven by celebrity chefs?
Oh, I absolutely think it is. I'm glad that talented young people are going into it. I'm glad it has lost its servant status. But I really think that it has to be more about pride than ego. You can be a very good chef who takes pride in his work without exerting your ego all over the place. And I am not too interested in hearing anything about the chef until I've had some dinners there. Then I will decide whether he's worth being interested in, not the other way around. I think people go in carrying so much baggage from what they read about, you know, the provenance of the chef, that they're afraid not to like it. They're afraid there's something wrong with them if they don't like it.
Yeah. Worst dish you ever tasted, best dish you ever tasted. Can you do that? Because there have been thousands.
Well, one that I do describe in the book, a woman who had been a servant to my husband's uncle who died, and we went to see her, and she invited us to this little sort of cabin. And although the first course was very good, the second course was something described to me as land eels, which looked like cold white fingers cut off a hand. They sort of had the fins on, so they looked hairy. And
what do you say to if this isn't a home? So what do you say?
You say it's delicious, and you eat it as quickly as possible. At which point, I got another helping dumped on my plate. So it took a lot of bread to get it all down.
And the best.
I would say the one that I appreciated best was a dinner at Chez Lamy Louis in about, 1976, 1977, when the Times sent me to France. And it was things like roast chicken, perfect roasted lamb, wonderful snails, no ideas, no creativity, just simple perfection. Mm. And about 2 weeks from today, I will be back there seeing if that still holds up. I have been there intermittently through the years, and I've never been disappointed, even though it has changed ownership.
Well, Mimi, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Food critic Mimi Sheridan, whose new book is called Eating My Words, An Appetite for Life.
Baby, take me out to eat.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
I see that scarlet field. Yeah, yeah. Can we put aside our politics for just one day? Oh, no, no, no. They got free reign.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.